From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Andrea Seabrook. Let's think now about the distant future, about a time when the world is run by robots. It's this week's Science Out of the Box. Those ruling androids will look back to pioneers of the robot revolution. Sojourner, the NASA rover that trekked over Mars. HAL, the bossy computer from 2001 A Space Odyssey. And they'll definitely look back to 2003 when the Robot Hall of Fame opened. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce stopped in Pittsburgh this week for this year's induction ceremony.
Right now, the Robot Hall of Fame has no physical hall you can walk through. That will come next year when the Carnegie Science Center in Pittsburgh opens a new exhibit. Tonight, the center is just hosting a party. Right inside the door, guests are greeted by what seems to be an astonishing little robot called Quasi.
Oh, you guys want to hear some awesome robot jokes?
Yeah.
What do you call a robot who's always getting lost? R2-D-Tor.
It's amazing how many people think, wow, artificial intelligence has really come of age. It's like, no, it's an actor. There's an actor behind it.
Don Marinelli says Quasi is not actually a robot. It's a high-tech puppet. Marinelli is a drama professor at Carnegie Mellon University, which founded the Robot Hall of Fame. He says people are so used to seeing robots in movies and TV that they now have totally unrealistic expectations of what a robot should be able to do in real life. So this was the first controversy faced by the builders of the Robot Hall of Fame. Should they include famous fake robots or just real ones?
There was a real concern that the fictional robots would skew people's expectations so that when they saw a robot that did widgets, it would seem somehow less impressive than Gort, which could incinerate the Earth.
Gort, of course, is from the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still. And he's in the Hall of Fame, because it turns out the Hall will accept fantasy robots, along with real-world ones, like Unimate, the first industrial robot. It did dull, repetitive work on a GM assembly line in 1961. Marinelli is on a jury of distinguished scientists and artists who get together every year to decide what else should be in the Hall.
There is definitely tension and conflict when it comes to deciding who should get in first.
One exception was when jury member Arthur C. Clarke nominated one of his own fictional creations.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
No one said, I can't do that to Clarke, even though Hal is usually considered a computer.
Nobody was willing to say, but Sir Arthur... Hal is a lens and a red light. I mean, we didn't want to go there. It was like, sure, Hal, why not?
Sometimes robots that don't win can feel hurt.
And rather cruelly, R2-D2 was one of the first inductees.
Anthony Daniels says it was cruel because he played the other famous Star Wars robot, C-3PO, the tall golden one that wasn't in the first group of inductees. He says C-3PO wasn't bitter exactly.
He just noted it and was a little silent when R2 came home boasting with his memorial plaque that he'd been given. But always right the next year.
That's because the next year, C-3PO got in too. And now, the man inside the gold suit serves as master of ceremonies.
For the Robot Hall of Fame, Anthony Daniels!
This year, only one fictional invention got in. Lieutenant Commander Data from Star Trek. He was joined by real robots, like Mindstorms, the popular Lego kit, plus NavLab 5. That's a high-tech minivan that drove itself from Pittsburgh to San Diego in 1995. Another inductee was the Raybert Hopper, a one-legged robot invented by Mark Raybert in the early 1980s.
All it does is hop around in a lab, go back and forth.
But Raybert says the Hopper pioneered new ideas about balance and motion that let other robots walk in a much more natural way. So even though this electronic pogo stick will look incredibly humble next to famous sci-fi characters in the Robot Hall of Fame, it's just the kind of real-world technology that might someday make them a reality. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
More than half of the world's northern fur seals live on two tiny islands, Alaskan islands, in the middle of the Bering Sea. The number of those seals has been steadily dropping for years. And now biologists hope a new study will help them figure out what's causing this decline. An answer can't come too soon for the people who live there, as Alaska Public Radio Network's Annie Feit reports.
In the peak summer breeding season, the fur seals on St. Paul Island outnumber humans 1,000 to 1. The imposing animals can weigh up to 600 pounds and are covered in dense brown fur. They crowd under rocky beaches like this one that surround the treeless island. But today's crowds are tiny compared to the 1950s, when hundreds of thousands more seals dotted the landscape. Greg Freitas is an Aleut elder who used to work as a fur seal conservation monitor. He says he first became concerned about the population a decade ago.
I checked the rookeries every day, twice a day, observing seals, counting them. And right there and then, I noticed the decline. I don't have to count them. I could see the areas where they used to occupy. Grasses are growing.
Aleut natives take a small number of seals each year for food. Brined seal flipper is a local delicacy. Other parts of the seal are used for clothes and crafts. In a modern twist on an ancient art, one local resident is now turning seal esophagus, which looks kind of like thin white leather, into stylish iPod covers. Freda says he can't imagine Aleut culture without the fur seal.
The fur seal is us. Without the fur seal, they used to say, we don't exist.
The fur seal population is now declining at the troubling rate of about 5% a year. And on a cold fall morning, four federal biologists are working to figure out why. They're trying to catch a female who's returning from a feeding trip. The animal has been outfitted with tags that will give the scientists a map of her movements during her days at sea. But first, they have to find her. Carrie Kuhn holds up an antenna, trying to catch her signal.
It's a very faint signal.
The biologists spend most of the day creeping along the frozen beach on their stomachs. When they finally find the seal, she's not happy. There are lots of theories on what could explain the decline, including environmental contaminants, ecosystem change, and even killer whale predation. Biologist Brian Fadley calls it an ecological puzzle.
You know, there are a whole lot of sources of mortality for these guys, and so far have been no easy way to figure out what it is that's really controlling the populations.
This new study will help determine whether the seals are finding enough food, which could be an important factor. The animal's favorite prey is pollock, but they compete with one of the largest commercial fisheries in the world. Concerns about pollock stocks triggered a significant drop in the number of fish the industry is allowed to catch this year. And for St. Paul resident Greg Freitas, the connection is obvious.
I blame the fishing industry. I mean, nobody's shooting them, and killer whale's not going to take all of them. So where's the rest going?
But the fishing industry says it's far too early to link the pollock fleet with the decline. Paul McGregor is an industry representative.
There's no doubt that the populations are declining, but that doesn't mean that the people that are conducting fishing operations are the reason for that. What we need to do is find out why the decline is happening before we start pinning the blame on somebody.
Biologist Brian Fadley agrees there isn't enough information yet to draw a connection, but he's optimistic his team can eventually figure out why the animals are struggling. For NPR News, I'm Annie Feit in Anchorage.
It is Thursday morning, which is when we talk about your health, and this morning we'll talk about your teeth, bleaching them. If you're willing to pay, techniques such as Bright Smile and Zoom are marketed as a breakthrough. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports on whether they work any better than less expensive bleaching gels or over-the-counter white strips.
The Center for Dental Health in Washington, D.C.'s Tony's Spring Valley neighborhood has the feel of a spa and offers many high-end procedures. But one thing you won't find here is a Zoom light or any other kind of light for teeth whitening. Dentist Eric Morrison says the jury's still out on whether the light is effective.
That's very true. What they're showing is that it isn't providing a significant difference in the result.
Meaning if you want to whiten your teeth, bleaching gels used alone can be just as effective as sitting in your dentist's office under a light. The first bit of evidence that light-activated systems may not enhance the results of bleaching was published in a dentistry journal back in 2003. Researcher Lee Hansen explains there was an assumption that heat from the light served as a catalyst to decompose the bleaching gel.
That's the theory behind it, but it's incorrect for two reasons.
Hansen, who's a retired chemistry professor, explains in order to accelerate the chemical reaction of the gel, you'd need a decent amount of ultraviolet light and heat. But most of the UV light is filtered out of the whitening lamps because the exposure would sunburn people's gums.
So all you have in the light is visible light, and so none of that light is absorbed. It's all simply reflected back out, so it can't do anything.
To test his theory, Hansen's colleagues at Clinical Research Associates, considered to be the Consumer Reports of Dentistry, tried a combination of bleach and light on a small group of patients. On one side of their mouths, they used bleaching gel alone, and on the other side, they added the light. At the end of the study, all the teeth were whiter, but there was no difference between the two sides. Dentist Jerry Kugel of Tufts University says this one study was by no means a final word on light-activated bleaching. He says a lot of patients do seem to like the procedure. When they leave the dentist chair after an hour-long session, many can see the difference, and they may assume it's all from the light.
You got to remember, they're getting peroxide on their teeth. You know, with the Zoom, it's 25%. Some of the other ones, it's even higher. And so they do leave with a whitening effect.
But within about 7 days, when the teeth rehydrate, studies show there's a rebound in the color. That's why most patients are sent home with more bleaching gel that they can apply at home. Kugel says jump-starting the process with an in-office light bleaching, which typically costs about $500, does seem to offer a time advantage.
My argument is it's so minimal that I don't see it being worth what, you know, people are being charged for this. I just don't get it.
Lots of dentists may disagree with Kugel. About 20,000 of them offer Zoom, and another few thousand use Bright Smile. Both are owned by Discus Dental. Dentist Marilyn Ward directs training for the company.
We have strong clinical studies showing that you do have statistical significance in light versus no light.
Zoom started to take off as a brand several years ago after company founder Bill Dorfman began appearing on the hit TV show Extreme Makeover. As the program's aesthetic dentist, he repeatedly touted Zoom. All the consumer interest piqued the curiosity of researcher Joe Ontiveros. He's a dentist at the University of Texas. He's just finished a study, partly funded by Discus Dental, analyzing the effects of bleach alone compared to the Zoom light on a small group of patients.
For some people, it was dramatic, and some people, you could barely tell the difference.
Ontiveros says for his patients, he still recommends at-home tray bleachings first.
Because it's just got a long track record, and it's very predictable.
At the end of the day, experts who study bleaching do agree on one fact. That is that hydrogen peroxide works.
I've always said in my lectures, bleach is bleach is bleach.
Researcher Harold Hyman says there's a pretty simple formula here. If you want quick results, go for a high concentration of peroxide. If you've got more time or you're more sensitive to the chemicals, tray bleachings or Crest white strips can work just as well. Alison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
And that's your health on this Thursday morning. Should remind you that teeth, even in babies, come in all sorts of shades, and you can find out what determines tooth color and why we have wisdom teeth by going to npr.org/yourhealth.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Mary Roach has written a book about sex. Nonfiction. It's about sex research. At this point, you would expect an assurance that this is a serious book, clinical, not comical. And you would be wrong, because it is both clinical and comical. Mary Roach is a solid science journalist with a glorious sense of humor. That's probably why the title of her book is Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex. She last talked with us here about her book on cadavers. It was called Stiff. A warning, this interview includes references, mostly sober references, to sex organs and also to polyester. In Bonk, Roach explores the current state and the history of research into human sexuality, and she drafts her husband into service as a study subject with her. She also introduces readers to trailblazers in the field, some of whom I'd heard of, Alfred Kinsey, Masters and Johnson. But there were some I hadn't heard of, like Robert Latou Dickinson, a Brooklyn-based physician.
Robert Latou Dickinson was a phenomenal man. He was a gynecologist working in the 1890s through about the 1930s. He's actually the man who got Kinsey interested in sex. Kinsey had been studying gall wasp speciation, had no inkling of what lay ahead for him, then met this man, Robert Latou Dickinson. In his gynecological practice, Dickinson began asking patients systematically about their sex lives and not, you know, how is it, but what do you do and how do you have an orgasm and how are things going for you? And so he had these detailed case studies, and he began to see that there were a lot of very unhappy and unsatisfied people, and he began going further along and actually started doing some physiological testing. And back then, there wasn't a lot of fancy equipment. So Dr. Dickinson at one point became interested in what exactly goes on inside people when they're having sex. And he used a test tube. He actually inserted it and would shine a light so he could actually see what was going on in there. That if the test tube were standing in for the penis, then you would see, you know, where is it hitting? Is it hitting the cervix? And there was, at the time, it was believed that the penis actually interlocked with the cervix, which is not true. Mm-hmm. And he could see that, in fact, it wasn't even hitting anywhere near the head of the cervix. And he was able to sort of debunk the coital interlocking theory. So he was really the first man to take a really scientific laboratory approach to figuring out what happens when people have sex.
And he was doing this in the early decades of the 20th century. And he, I mean, do we know if lots of his patients were turning him down and were put off by these questions, or were they all?
As far as I could tell, they were amazingly cooperative. I went into one of the archives where some of his files are, and he kept these detailed note cards with the responses that people were giving him. And they were very, very forthcoming and seemed to have no qualms about it. And this is, I think, actually the 1920s were a surprisingly open-minded and freewheeling era. This was before the 40s and 50s when we swang back the other way. The 1920s, there were sex manuals at the time that were encouraging women to try being on top. They were talking about the clitoris. The 1920s were almost like the 60s in a way. And then we swang back to a more conservative era.
Now, as you said, Dr. Dickinson, Dr. Robert Latou Dickinson, was the person whose work inspired Alfred Kinsey. In passing, you note, I'm reading a quote now. I give you a sentence, my favorite sentence in the entire oeuvre of Alfred Kinsey from Sexual Behavior in the Human Female. Quote, cheese crumbs spread in front of a copulating pair of rats may distract the female, but not the male.
That's my favorite, yes. He was making the point that the female, the human female he was talking about, is more prone to distraction during sex. He was talking about, in general, the male and the female to a certain extent. When you're very, very aroused, a tremendous amount of stuff can be going on around you and you won't notice. Your peripheral vision kind of cuts out. You don't notice if somebody's, you know, picking your pocket, and prostitutes have used this to great benefit. You don't feel pain nearly as much. Mm-hmm. Something that would be painful otherwise is just sort of registers as a mild tactile stimulation. So anyway, it was in that passage of the book that he mentioned the copulating rats and the cheese crumbs.
One of the more exotic studies that you write about was published in, was it European Urology, by an Egyptian doctor?
Yes. That was my favorite study of all time. Dr. Shafik, he's an extraordinary gentleman in that he funds his own research. He's a surgeon, but he's done a lot of research in the realm, the whole pelvic area. So he's done proctology, urology, andrology, sexology. And I came across him kind of arbitrarily. I found this paper in which he was looking at the effects of polyester fabric on the fertility and incidence of copulation in rats. And
I didn't know that rats wore polyester.
Well, normally they don't, but in Dr. Shafik's lab, he actually outfitted laboratory rats in tiny little polyester trousers. And there's a little diagram in the paper. And this is a legitimate research paper published in a peer-reviewed journal. And there's a line drawing of a rat wearing these tiny little trousers, and on the caption says, the underpant worn by the rat.
I gather Dr. Shafik passed away last year, you told me.
Yes, in October he passed away.
And he found in that particular study that wearing polyester, wearing polyester, diminished the fertility of the rats. But you at least admit the possibility that perhaps he was just wearing anything or dressing funny might also diminish the fertility of anyone.
Yes, the incidence of copulations, I think, whether you're a rat or a human male wearing those trousers. I mean, you kind of need to see the trousers, but they're very... There's a little hole for the tail, and they're drawstring at the top, and they're not very attractive. And I think it would be kind of hard to get a date in that case, yes.
Well, after meeting people like Dr. Shafik in Cairo, and you and your husband taking part in a study with Dr. Deng in London, and so many other interviews you report on in the book, I mean, what do you come away? What's the takeaway knowledge you have from having written Bonk?
Well, I think that one of the things that I'm left with is a lingering sense of surprise that there are still a good number of mysteries in the realm of sexual physiology. You kind of have the sense that as a person who has sex, you figure, well, you know, it seems to work. What else do we need to know? Which is kind of a ridiculous attitude. That would be like somebody saying to a person who's studying, say, the esophageal sphincter, well, we all know how to eat. Why do we need to study that? Mm-hmm. So I come up against that all the time. People saying, well, what's the point of this research? You know, tell me something I don't know about sex. We don't know, for example, the mechanisms of ejaculation, what the trigger is for that. And there have been all kinds of elaborate and quite frightening little studies that have been done in that realm. Just any number of things that we really should still be looking into, and yet it's very difficult for sex researchers to get funding for purely anatomical and physiological research these days.
Well, Mary Roach, author of Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
And you can read more about rodents and synthetic clothing, and you can hear Mary give me the scoop on her own experience as an ultrasound imaging guinea pig at our website, npr.org. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. From California to New England, wind energy is booming. Consumers and lawmakers are demanding more renewable energy, and the result is an unprecedented growth in wind farms. From a distance, the spinning turbines can seem beautiful, but in some communities, living with them has gotten a bit ugly. Continuing our series, Shifting Ground, independent producer David Barron has the story of one family blown apart by the wind.
A snow-covered road rises from the Black River Valley onto Tug Hill in Lewis County, New York. This is Yancey Road, home to the Yancey family for generations.
My parents lived here and my grandfather lived here.
John Yancey has lived here his whole life. He's 48. And he's not pleased with the recent changes in the neighborhood.
We've got nothing but windmills.
Windmills surround him.
We'll start here on the north. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
The turbines are white, sleek, enormous, 20 stories tall, with blades 3 times longer than a Greyhound bus.
42, 43.
Almost 200 turbines sprawl across an area larger than Manhattan. This is the Maple Ridge Wind Farm, the largest wind power facility in the East. It opened 2 years ago, and it's transformed the way this rural area looks and sounds.
You'll hear that whoosh, whoosh, whoosh.
John Yancey says when the wind comes from the right direction, the sound penetrates his house, his bedroom, his consciousness.
I don't sleep.
Most of the noise comes from one turbine. It's just across the street. And what makes it especially upsetting, the turbine is on his father's land.
I asked him not to have it installed there, to ask the company to either move it or delete it. But they built it, and now I have to suffer with it.
John and a couple of his brothers are angry at their father for allowing 7 turbines on his land. One brother, Herb Yancey, grows corn and hay on his father's farm. He says the wind towers and their access roads have fragmented the land.
And now you have all these little fields with no straight borders on them any place. It made farming a nightmare.
Then there's their brother Gordon. He owns a nearby inn that's popular with snowmobilers. He used to enjoy an unobstructed view of the Adirondacks. Now he looks out on the wind towers.
They've taken away my peacefulness, my serenity, my ability to walk outside on my property and enjoy the quietness of the morning sun, the quietness of the setting sun.
And Gordon barely speaks to his father anymore.
I feel that he sold the family out.
My name is Edward Yancey. I was born in 1916.
Ed Yancey's hearing isn't so good, and when I ask him about the turbines that have divided him from his sons, it's not clear he understands. But there's a simple reason he agreed to windmills on his land. He receives lease payments of more than $45,000 a year.
It helps out. Helps pay the taxes.
His daughter, Virginia Yancey Leindecker, sides with her father in this family dispute. She says he would have been foolish not to lease his land for wind towers.
My theory is, if you're going to, they're all going to be around you, and you're going to see them. And if you got the property, you might as well partake, because why should you go and say, I'm too important to take money?
Money, fairness, a sense that decisions were not made democratically. These are the core issues that explain the Yancey family rift, and it's a rift that split the broader community, too. Many people here like the wind farm. It's brought jobs and tax dollars. Some consider the turbines beautiful. But resentment has bubbled up because those who have a lot of land and a lot of windmills make a lot of money, while their land-poor neighbors receive next to nothing.
It has caused friction, family against family or neighbor against neighbor.
Arlie Rice is town supervisor for Lowville, New York, one of the three towns that host the Maple Ridge Wind Farm. Wind projects have now been proposed for other communities in the region, and residents of those towns often seek his advice.
When I go other places, I say, just sit down and think how you can benefit everyone.
Okay, well, let's do this. Why don't you come up and get a sheet of paper and a marker?
That question, how to make wind power something everyone can benefit from, was put recently to an eighth-grade science class at Lowville's middle school. The teacher, Debbie Yancey, Herb's wife, Ed's daughter-in-law. She broke the students into teams.
Okay, and we're talking windmills, guys, windmills.
The students came up with several ideas for improving wind farm development. Among them, require that windmills be set back farther from neighboring homes. Hold a town vote on whether to allow the project. And don't let wind power companies negotiate deals one-on-one with individual landowners.
They got to do it as a community thing.
They have to do it as a community thing.
Yeah. It'd make the windmills better because
the community would get that money.
And then they could figure out where they wanted to plant them. If someone didn't want it, it didn't need to be there. It could go somewhere else.
Go somewhere else, okay. So everybody's kind of all in it together.
It's a win-win situation.
A win-win situation.
But wind power does involve trade-offs, and they're not always easy. How do you weigh the potential harm to neighbors against the benefit to the planet? Is it worth giving up the view you're used to in exchange for economic gains? Such questions don't just divide communities and families. They sometimes leave individuals internally conflicted. John Yancey, who's so upset about the windmill across the street that keeps him up nights, he's a union electrician. He helped build the wind towers.
They needed manpower, and our union supplied it.
Did you work on the ones on your dad's land?
Yes, I did. I thought that it possibly would be something that I'd be proud to say that, yes, I helped build this turbine across the road, but now I'm eating my words.
And now that the windmills have come, John Yancey says he may go and leave his home on Yancey Road. For NPR News, I'm David Barron.
And you can hear more stories from the Shifting Ground series at our website, npr.org.
Support for the series Shifting Ground comes from the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. A battle over children's health is affecting which kids are getting federal help. The state children's health insurance program, known as SCHIP, was designed to cover children and families too poor to afford private insurance, but not poor enough to get Medicaid. The Bush administration wants to make an even finer distinction. It's telling states to take care of the very poorest children before providing care to kids whose families have a little more money. It sounds straightforward, but as NPR's Julie Robner reports, many states are claiming the new requirement will cause nightmares for some families.
At issue is a letter Bush officials sent out last August. The letter said that starting this August, lower-income children should get coverage before those in families that earn more. As a result, some states have already been forced to cancel their expansion plans. In Ohio, the cancellation has left all three of Paula Novak's children uninsured, including 4-year-old Seth, who was born with Down syndrome. At a Senate hearing yesterday, Novak said he's been hurt the most by missing needed care.
Seth had open-heart surgery in 2007 and missed his 1-year cardiology follow-up. Seth has missed appointments for eye exams, thyroid exams, ENT visits to replace tubes in his ears, genetic doctor appointments to track his growth and development, fittings for his orthotics, and very importantly, because Seth is still nonverbal, visits to a speech therapist.
Democratic lawmakers in particular have been outraged by the administration's action. Because of the change, states will no longer be able to enroll children in the SCHIP program in families with incomes over 250% of poverty, that's about $44,000 for a family of three, unless the state can prove it's already enrolled 95% of children in families at 2x poverty, about $35,000. West Virginia Senator Jay Rockefeller, who chaired the hearing, accused the administration of having motives beyond prioritizing coverage of poor children.
In my judgment, its aim is simple, to make it virtually impossible to provide greater access to health insurance for children. This is repugnant.
But Dennis Smith, who heads the SCHIP program for the Bush administration, defended the change. He said many states would be just fine.
Currently, there are 17 states above 250% of the federal poverty level. Based in our discussions with them, at least 9 of those states, based on their data and the guidance that we have provided, will in fact meet that 95% threshold.
But the calculations the administration is using, counting children as covered, for example, even if they only have insurance for a small part of the year, have led to accusations of fuzzy math. Here's how Congressional Budget Office Director Peter Orszag put it when he was asked to judge the administration's methodology.
It reminds me of the joke about the guy who won a lottery by picking the number 36, and someone said, "Why'd you pick 36?" And he said, "Well, I've got 6 grandkids, and their average age is 7, and 6 times 7 is 36.
In other words, the administration's calculations don't make a lot of sense. Alan Weil of the National Academy of State Health Policy said there's another reason to continue to allow states to enroll higher-income children in their SCHIP programs.
States have found that higher eligibility levels are an effective means for attracting lower-income children into the program. Broadening eligibility reinforces the message that health insurance programs are not tied to welfare and that they are designed for working families.
Democrats have vowed to overturn the Bush policy in legislation before it takes effect this August, but they'll need enough Republicans to override a near-certain presidential veto. And so far, it's not clear whether they'll get them. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.